is a place that I go for some sweet inspiration, a place that I know for the healing of the nations. There is a place in this town where they share a human vision. So come on downtown, feel the power of their mission. Come on downtown, share the power of their vision. If you are looking for love, I cannot tell you what to do. If you're looking for truth, look inside of you. If you're looking for God, that's between God and you. If you're looking for peace, tell your friends the news. If you're looking for peace, tell everyone the news. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall every day. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall every night, every day, every night. Through all kinds of weather, getting stronger and better. They got the power because they got the heart and they got the vision. If you are feeling helpless and you don't know where to start, before taking action, take back your heart. If you have lost it, you can find it if you go camping too, with Gandhi and friends at City Hall with you. With Gandhi and family at City Hall right there with you. Violence are as old as the hills. It's our nature to love, not our nature to kill. So down at the peace camp, it's no mystery. They're simply doing what comes naturally. They're simply being what comes naturally. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall every day. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall every night, every day, every night. Through all kinds of weather, getting stronger and better. They got the power because they got the heart and they got the vision. It's our nature to love, not our nature to kill. So down at the peace camp, it's no mystery. They're simply doing what comes naturally. They're simply being what comes naturally. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall. Come on down, Gandhi's camping out at City Hall, won't you join him? Gandhi's camping out at City Hall every day. Gandhi's camping out at City Hall every night, every day, every night. Through all kinds of weather, getting stronger and better. They got the power because they got the heart and they got the vision.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to Does Science Refute God? Is belief in God rational, or has science shown the existence of God to be so unlikely as to make belief irrational?
Actually, getting to something I'm very curious about, and that's the issue of miracles. I want to put to the side, and you in particular, Ian Hutchinson, who is arguing against the notion that science refutes God. What is a miracle if not a violation of the laws of physics? Does it not violate the laws of physics? And if it does so, how is that even possible, and how does that fit into this argument?
So what we call the laws of physics, from a Christian point of view, are the way that God normally orders the universe, the normal behavior of things round about us. Boyle, who was one of the founders of the Royal Society, wrote a whole book about what nature is. And what he advocated was that what we mean or should mean by nature is the normal course of events. Now, of course, miracles are not the normal course of events. And by the way, it didn't take science to tell us that. You know, people in the first century knew that people don't rise from the dead when they've been hung on crosses. And people knew that women don't bear children unless, well, you know what. So, yes, miracles are abnormal events, usually abnormal.
But why does science not refute those things? As in, they seem to be impossible.
It's simply not the case that you have to presume that the laws of nature are universally inviolable. It's simply not necessary to do science to do that.
Lawrence Krauss.
Well, that's ridiculous. In fact, it's ridiculous to the science that you do. When you do science, you're presuming that the results of an experiment in your laboratory apply in another laboratory. Miracles in your particular religion, it's kind of remarkable that these violations of the laws of nature only occurred before video cameras and intelligence squared and the internet, and that you have these remarkable violations of the laws of nature in a book which I was really surprised to hear Dinesh call a scientific document, the Bible. I hope he really didn't mean that. St. Augustine would be very upset with you because he said the Bible wasn't scientific. But these violations of the laws of nature only occurred at a time when there was no evidence for them.
But Lawrence,
and you believe it.
Lawrence, but is there a logical argument that you can make against miracles? Not the I didn't see them and nobody has seen them lately argument.
Our logic is determined by nature, not by what we'd like. And nature has told us that miracles don't happen. That's it. It's not what I want or what I think should be rational. It's do they happen, and there's no evidence that they've ever happened.
Dinesh D'Souza.
I think we have here a deep fallacy, and the fact that it remains a fallacy shows that what is being called science is actually hiding behind a philosophical principle. It was the philosopher Hume who pointed out 200 years ago that from no amount of empirical generalizations, however large, can you draw a general law that is true as a matter of logic. Let's say you measure the speed at which this pen falls down. You can measure it a million times, but you don't know that on a star 10 light years away or in some other condition where you haven't measured it, that if you drop this pen, it will fall at the same speed. Science presumes it. It doesn't
prove
it. Hang on.
I'm sorry. We measure it.
Let me finish. Right. But you can't measure it always and everywhere. And you haven't measured it 10,000 years ago. You're assuming that 10,000. No, you're assuming that 10,000 years ago, it happened at the same speed. And your measurement is based on that. So Hume's point is this. Science provides general propositions based on experience. But he said we should always be willing to accept new experience that proves the opposite.
I agree with you in that. Science can only prove what's wrong, not something that's absolutely true. So you're right. If I drop a ball a million times and it falls, I, in principle, could imagine an experiment where it wouldn't, but that's highly likely it's going to fall the next time. But you use the key word, experience. We wait, then, for an experience that contradicts the known laws. So if tonight, when I looked up at the sky, the stars rearranged themselves and said, I am here, in Aramaic or ancient Greek or whatever you want, then I might say, you know, there's something to it. But the point is there's been no experience that violates the fact that the laws have existed throughout all time.
Lawrence, you haven't had such an experience,
right.
But there are probably people in this room who have. The question fundamentally comes down to what counts as empirical. And in science, of course, what counts as empirical are things that we can do experiments on. We can do repeated observations. So science depends upon reproducibility. So it's in the nature of miracle that it can't be reduced into scientific form.
But if there was ever a miracle that happened, and tell me one that happened that you can show happened.
Let's let Michael Schumer.
But even so, even if there was one, let's say, Ian, that petitionary prayer actually works. Again, as a physicist...
Petitionary prayer, you mean, I would like something to happen, and then you pray for it.
Petitioning to the deity to, say, cure my cancer or whatever. And it happens. Wouldn't you be curious to know how the deity, or whatever it is, reaches into the world, stirs the particles, reconfigures the DNA so the cancer cells quit replicating so rapidly and so on? And the moment you figure that out as a scientist, it would no longer be a miracle. It wouldn't be supernatural. It would just be part of nature.
Well, let's be clear that it's never been a religious position that if we have a natural explanation for something, that means that God is absent or that God didn't do it. It's always been a biblical viewpoint that even on things which we know are part of nature, God can be considered to be active in those things.
John, I just want to correct
Lawrence Krauss, and then I'll come back.
I don't think you meant it, Ian,
Lawrence
so
Krauss.
I want to just make it clear. The laws of physics are deterministic. Our observations aren't deterministic, but the underlying laws are deterministic. Nothing's changed in 400 years. And so it's really important to recognize there's no way...
The universe isn't deterministic.
Wait a minute.
It's governed by quantum
mechanics. Just one thing, because we've gotten to four syllables and I'm not that smart. Just give us a working definition of the word deterministic. You mean you start with an initial condition
for the equations of quantum mechanics, and the evolution of the system is determined unambiguously.
It has
to
happen.
No uncertainty. Your measurement of the system has uncertainty, but the evolution of the underlying system is completely determined.
I'll accept the slight correction.
So to the side, arguing that against the motion that science refutes God, is it your position that there are certain things that science can know, and then there are certain things that science can't know, therefore doesn't refute God? How large is that category of things that we can't know, and is science just irrelevant to that category of knowledge?
There are some questions in which Christians and religious believers are making factual claims. God made the universe. It's a factual claim. Either he did or he didn't. There is life after death. We may have no way to find out, but that's a factual claim. Either there is or there isn't. Now, religion also makes moral claims. This is how you should live. This is a happy life, and so on. So religion operates in two domains. The second domain is untouchable by science. Science can try to give accounts of how morality originated, but that's not the same thing as what you should and shouldn't do.
Before you move on, let me go to Michael Shermer on that.
Well, so where do we get our morals from? It can't be from the Bible, because almost nobody obeys, certainly not the Old Testament, and most of the New Testament. I mean, death penalty for adultery, there goes half of Congress. I mean, nobody is going to do this, right? So we pick and choose, we cherry pick from the holy books based on something else that's happened that I referenced in my opening statement of there's been this other change that's happened, this secularization of morality. And so that's been the changer. So even if you and I both listen to the still small voice within to decide what's right or wrong, Dinesh, I'm claiming you're not getting it from the Bible, and I'm not either. We're getting it from somewhere else. I think we've evolved this propensity to have moral emotions, and then culture tweaks them, and we've been getting progressively more moral.
But what's telling us what is actually right or wrong?
But I think science does tell us what's right and wrong.
Sorry, Lawrence Krauss.
I think science does tell us what's right and wrong in a real way.
Really?
We have learned, for example, the scientific facts that certain animals can suffer, for example, affects our decision of how we should treat those animals, whether we should eat them or not eat them, or the scientific evidence that certain people of certain colors don't have different intellects, different capabilities, has changed the way we deal with other humans.
But at bottom,
science has determined the way we behave in the modern world.
Ian Hutchinson.
I don't think it's the case that it tells us right or wrong. I think science does often inform us in ways that help us to implement our morals and our ethics more effectively, more fairly, more accurately, and more truly. But in the end, it cannot tell us whether it's right or wrong to do something, because categories of right and wrong aren't scientific categories.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debating on America's shores. Four panelists are arguing for and against this motion: science refutes God. Stay with us.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debating on America's shores.
We are in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared US debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator. We have four debaters, two teams of two, arguing it out over this motion: science refutes God. To the team that is arguing for the motion that science refutes God, I want to ask you, it's somewhat of a personal question, can a scientist believe in God and still be a functioning scientist?
Absolutely. There are functioning scientists and who can believe in God. There are functioning scientists who are pedophiles. There are functioning scientists who are... No, I'm serious. I mean, the point is, scientists are human.
That was a very, very, very rough grouping that you just did. I don't know, in the spirit of this thing, if you want to step back from that.
But what I want to point out is that people are not fully rational. As a very famous biologist said, when I go into the laboratory, I become an atheist, because when I twiddle the knobs in my experiment, I don't believe there's some angel affecting the results of the experiment. Some people choose to believe it outside. The minute they take it into the laboratory, they stop being good scientists.
Ian Hutchinson.
That's actually quite contrary to history. I mean, what got modern science going in the first place was a belief in the faithfulness of God, a creator who'd made a rational creation. And a good case can be made that the reason why science as we know it, modern science, grew up in the West was in part because Christianity, in its philosophical and theological viewpoints, served as a kind of a hospitable environment in which that science could grow up.
But I get the sense, though, that the other side is arguing that as science progressed, and the more that scientists knew, the more tempting atheism became for them because of the volume and because of the discoveries and because they found inconsistencies. What about that? Do you want to take that, Dinesh D'Souza?
Well, I think there's a presumption that science explains the material world. So it is a presumption of modern science, not a proof, but a presumption, that beyond the material world, there is nothing. So take, for example, the fact that as humans, we experience consciousness. We know that there's something in us, consciousness, that can't be reduced simply to materialism.
How do you know that?
Hold on a second. No, hold on a second. When you say, how do you know that, you're presuming that it is. Do you agree that the cause of consciousness is not known?
The fact that something is not known does not imply it's God. You better not get
right,
that.
Right, but neither... So consciousness is an immaterial thing that may have a material explanation, and the key word is may. And yet you as a scientist believe it does.
I don't believe anything. I just want to hear...
You just said that all causes
works.
Are material.
I'll wait for the experiments and the theory.
Ah, so in other words, you're presuming...
Watch out.
I'm saying, as a scientist, you are closed off to the possibility of non-material explanations, true or false.
No, I told you, if the stars moved around today, I'd be really thinking there's some intelligence in the universe. There's just never been such an observation. So, there is, I'll assume the reasonable, logical thing, since there's never been such an observation, there's unlikely to be one.
Gentleman in the blue shirt.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Orstrom, and my question is directed to the panelists opposing the motion. Could you respond to Michael Shermer's assertion that, in fact, each of you are atheists 999 times over, and your adoption of Christianity is merely a happenstance of the culture in which you grew up? Could you respond to that?
Dinesh D'Souza.
Well, first of all, in my case, that is flatly untrue because I was born and raised in India. So from a very young age, the Christianity in which I was born was problematic and had to be measured against other possibilities. But once you begin to study the other religions, you discover something very interesting, and that is that there are shared propositions of the different religions. One scholar described it very well. It's sort of like you have a mountain, and at the top of the mountain you have God, but no one can see him. And you have little rivers of knowledge pouring down, and you can look at the different religions as human attempts, flawed, to apprehend the same reality. So I don't see the other religions as wrong. I see all of us in a human enterprise to try to gain knowledge that seems beyond the reach of the empirical.
So you just eloquently described the geography of religious beliefs of India. When Lawrence goes to lecture in India, he doesn't discover that they do physics differently in India. They do physics everywhere around the world the same. There's just one physics. That's the larger point.
Right down the front here, please.
This is a question to you, Ian and Dinesh. Is there an observed phenomena for which the religious explanation has progressed ahead of the scientific explanation in terms of plausibility?
I'll answer that.
Dinesh D'Souza.
If you look at the Bible, it doesn't claim to make scientific proofs. In fact, what's interesting about the Bible is it doesn't make proofs at all. The Bible doesn't even attempt to prove God. It asserts things. Why? Because for the most part, what the Bible is doing is it's in the province of revelation. Now, the Bible does make certain claims about the world and about man. The Bible doesn't say that God made man out of nothing. But it does say that God made the universe out of nothing. And so the Bible says God created the world and God created man, but the Bible doesn't say how. That's where science comes in. Science can attempt to give explanations that actually don't refute the Bible. You could refute the Bible by showing that actually the universe has always existed and doesn't require any explanation whatsoever.
Lawrence has had his head in his hand listening
well,
to
this.
You don't really want to go here,
Dinesh. So I would say, for example, we refute the Bible by arguing that creating day and night before you create the sun is pretty silly.
Well, Lawrence, in that case, here's the problem. You have a fundamentalist reading of the Bible that is, maybe subscribed to by 3% of Christians and 100% of atheists.
I brought that up because I thought you were essentially repeating a fundamental assertion that somehow the Bible makes some scientific claims that are substantial. And the whole point is you don't want to go there because you and I know that a fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible leads to nonsense.
We are in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator. We have four debaters, two teams of two, debating this motion, Science Refutes God. You will be our youngest ever questioner. There is no pressure on you whatsoever.
My name is David, and I'm a student at Collegiate School, and I would like to know from the side for the motion what your stance would be or what you would say to somebody that has had a spiritual experience.
Let Michael Shermer take that question.
Yeah, so we get this a lot. You know, how do you explain this or that? I think people's experiences are real, absolutely. Most people, when they experience, or they describe some miraculous, fantastic spiritual experience that they've had, they really mean it. Now, so the question is, what does it represent? Something out there in the world or something inside the brain? Well, we now know enough about neuroscience to know that the brain does generate a lot of these kind of spiritual experiences, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, hallucinations, delusions. And so the experiences are real. What we want to know as scientists is, well, what do they actually represent? I mean, we know we can replicate these in the lab by doing certain things and causing people's brains to have these experiences. So most likely, the what's more likely question, that it's out there or that it's in here, the overwhelming evidence is that they're in here.
Good question, and I want to actually take it to the other side.
We're talking here about an experience that has been had by perhaps 90% of people in the world from the beginning of time. So I would put the likelihood this way. If we went to a village and there were 100 people in the village and 95 of them said that they knew a guy named Bill, and there were 5% of the guys who said, nah, and 3 of them thought that the other 95 were lying, which is more likely, that there is a Bill and yet 95% of people are hallucinating? Or is it that there is a Bill and 5% just don't know the guy?
Sir,
well,
right
the quick answer is that there are Bills, and we've seen Bills.
Michael Shermer.
So that's different than an invisible God that may or may not exist.
And the point is, when you say the experience, you mean a personal perception that God exists. And the fact that something is maybe relatively universal suggests that we may be programmed, our evolutionary history programs us to have certain tendencies, and there's no doubt you'd be crazy to suggest that humans don't have a tendency to be religious. That would violate evidence of reality. So the fact that humans have a tendency to be religious is not, or belief in God, is not proof that God exists. It's just proof that humans have a tendency.
Okay.
Do you believe that your Christianity is absolute and true, or do you feel that you need to make a leap of faith there, and is a leap of faith scientific?
Ian Hutchinson.
Yes, I think faith is an important topic that we haven't touched on. And humans make decisions on the basis of incomplete evidence all the time during our lives. And it's people who act boldly and with determination and commitment who are the people who are, in the end, most successful in life. They act on the evidence that they have, even though that evidence is incomplete. Faith is that same principle of acting on the evidence we know, even though it's not complete, applied to matters of the spirit.
Lawrence Krauss.
As I said, in science we talk about likely and unlikely. In science, of course, and in life, we do, I agree, make decisions based on incomplete evidence. But the wonderful thing about science, the thing that makes science so much better than religion, is our faith is shakable. I'm proud of the fact that there's something I can believe with all my heart to be absolutely true, and the minute there's a bit of evidence that shows it isn't true, I throw it out like yesterday's newspaper. In fact, that's the one thing I recommend. I hope every student has in their experiences sometime in their life, something that they profoundly believe in to be true, based on faith, shown to be wrong, because that opens their mind, and that's what science does that religion doesn't.
And that concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is Science Refutes God.
47 years ago, so began the message of a war-weary President Abraham Lincoln, a message written on the back of an envelope on the train on the way to dedicate a battlefield where men from the North and South had died at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. 67 years ago, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. For the brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, and that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.